A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 1, 1998, in the series The Human Face of God, entitled Baptized, Claimed, and Called. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 41, verses 8 through 10, and Luke 3, verses 1 through 9 and 21 through 22. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Some of you will remember that some time ago when our story appeared in the New York Times, that the Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey, John Shelby Spong, reached out to me and wrote a nice letter and was encouraging. Subsequently invited Nancy and me to be their guests to hear Karen Armstrong, the British scholar, lecture in the diocese. I have several of his books, but I saw one on the shelf recently in the place of my most severe temptation, that is Barnes & Noble. And I found that it was the republication of an earlier work. And in that earlier work, entitled The Hebrew Lord, I found at the beginning of the first chapter these lines. It's entitled Christ Power. Look at him. Look not at his divinity, but look rather at his freedom. Look not at the exaggerated tales of his power, but look rather at his infinite capacity to give himself away. Look not at the first century mythology that surrounds him, but look rather at his courage to be, his ability to love, the contagious quality of his love. Stop your frantic search. Be still and know that this is God. This love, this freedom, this life, this being. And when you are accepted, accept yourself. When you are forgiven, forgive yourself. When you are loved, love yourself. Grasp that Christ power and dare to be yourself. When I read those lines, I knew that I had my Lenten task set out for me. For while Bishop Spong has been on the growing edge, on the forefront, a catalyst, a gadfly, pushing the church to the reinterpretation, translation of the gospel for our day, I am a late bloomer. But what he was about 25 years ago is what I began to do 25 years ago, slowly, cautiously. When I returned from Europe, it was a time in which New Testament scholarship was talking about Christology from below. That is, coming to understand the creedal exaltation of Jesus in those Christological formulas, Son of God, Son of David, Son of Man, etc. What the church was beginning to do through the development of its interpretation of Jesus, highly exalting him, was beginning to be understood as necessarily being understood from a focus on the historical Jesus, on that human Nazarene, in the title of the book, that Hebrew Lord. I began to drag some of you, willingly or not, along with me in my own pilgrimage to understand this Jesus, this one who was the historical happening that was the catalyst to launch what has become the whole Christian movement. To focus on that historical Jesus in order to understand what happened in him that resulted in the Christian church, that resulted in our being here together, I began to see that Jesus would not have recognized himself in our creedal statements. That those creedal statements were the interpretation of a historical experience, a historical person. And that it was to lay back the layers and uncover that historical person in which would lie the mystery of the incarnation. Because I was recognizing that it was in seeing the humanness of Jesus that one would discover the face of God. That it was not, as Bishop Spong says in this writing, to concentrate on the exaggerated tales of his power or the understandable mythology that surrounded him in that first century movement. Not to gaze on his deity, but to focus on his humanity, and paradoxically, to see Jesus, the human being, would be to see the face of God. That's the mystery. It was, 20 years before I actually preached an Eastertide series entitled From Proclaimer to the One Proclaimed, in which I said what I have just said, that this one who came proclaiming the kingdom of God ended up being the one who himself was proclaimed. In the midst of that series, there was a sermon entitled, How a Man Became God. Earlier than that, back in Lent of 1984, I had preached a sermon, Jesus, You Are Really Something. I remember that sermon because it was an existential moment for me. I can hardly remember what I preached a week ago at this advanced stage, in the springtime of senility. But I remember that sermon because I confessed that I had always been more moved by a Dietrich Bonhoeffer than a Jesus Christ. And I began to understand why. Bonhoeffer was like me. Bonhoeffer was human. My Jesus that I got from my parents and from my nurture in Sunday school and church and through all of my training, that Jesus was not really like me. That Jesus had a leg up on me. I mean, sure he was human, but. And the but was the big part of it. Didn't he have a card up his sleeve? Sure he walked through the dark valley. Sure he suffered. But didn't he know all the time? And doesn't that make a difference? And can that one really know the trouble I see? And then I began to realize it was Jesus, a man, who endured what he endured, who had a vision as he did and faithfully followed it to the end. Then I began to see the magnificence of his humanity. Then I began to see, Jesus, you are really something. For me, it was a turning point, a time of clarification. And I began to love him more and admire him more and stand more in awe of this one who was captivated by a vision, who was claimed and called and responded faithfully to the very end. And so when I read the lines from Bishop Spong, I said, aha, that's what we'll do. Once again, nothing really new, but once again, in this Lenten season, we will look to Jesus, not to the divinity or the exaggerated tales of his power or the mythology that surrounds all of the Christological creedal work of the church. We're going to look to Jesus in order that looking into the face of Jesus, we might see the face of God. For Jesus was one who was called, claimed and called by God. If there's anything certain, it is that he lived out of that strong conviction. There were 10 of us last weekend who were at Duke University at a Jesus in Context seminar. 7 scholars, 2 of the leading Jesus seminar scholars, Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan, 2 Jewish women who are into New Testament interpretation, along with 3 other scholars. There was great diversity among them, but they agreed on 2 points in terms of what you could really determine about the historical actuality of Jesus' life. One was that he was baptized by John, and the other was that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. It was like those were the bookends of his life. And the evangelists who wrote the story of Jesus decades after his death and resurrection pointed to his baptism by John as that moment of recognition of the claim and the call of God. Now, Israel lived, nurtured forever in the sense of being chosen. The Old Testament reading from 2 Isaiah, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, I will uphold you and strengthen you." That sense of chosenness. Perhaps some of the animosity against the Jewish people in all these centuries has been because they have had this sense of specialness, which is throughout the whole of the Hebrew Scriptures. They were a called people, an elect people, not as an end in itself, but in order that they might be light to the nations. Jesus entered into that whole tradition, of course. But all of the evangelists have him at the Jordan, baptized. And Luke says, the heavens opened, and the Spirit as a dove came down, and Jesus heard a voice saying, "You are my Son, my beloved one, in whom I am well pleased." Jesus had a sense of being claimed and called by God. How did he know? How does anyone know? How does one make oneself certain that indeed one has been claimed and called? Well, there is no proof. There is no verification possible. It is only in the fruits of the life that we can see the reality and authenticity of the call. Jesus said that, didn't he? "By their fruits you shall know them." Someone feels claimed and called by God, show me the fruits. Who can say whether one is claimed and called? But Jesus obviously was, and the fruits of his life gave indication of the fact that deep within him was that sense that it was God who had placed God's hand upon him. Claiming and calling by God is a dangerous business. We have to recognize that in the whole history of humankind, there has been more violence and devastation wrought by those who said they were claimed and called by God than perhaps any other reason. We have to recognize the fact that we live with something very dangerous there. Nonetheless, nothing significant has ever been done by anyone who hasn't had a sense of being claimed and called by God. What did it mean for Jesus? Well, what does it mean for anyone? He saw something. Saw in quotation marks. He understood something. He sensed something. There was some truth that overwhelmed him, that possessed him. He saw something. And he lived in to what he saw. And his life was filled with the fruit of that which he saw. Well, he yielded to it. Did he have to? No. No, I don't believe he did. There was a must in his life. But it is the must of one who has seen something. Could he have rejected the call? Yes, he could have, but to reject the call would have been to deny his soul. He would have died within. He had seen something. He had felt the grasp of the grip of God to say no. Yes, he could have said no, but he couldn't say no and be who he was. He had to be who he was because of what he saw. Claimed and called, he saw something. And he rose from the banks of the Jordan River and began to tread a path that led him to the gory hill of Golgotha. Did he know when he began where he would end up? I don't think so. Does anyone know when one responds to one's inward truth what the ramifications of that may be? I don't think so. But when one is being what one has to be because of what one has seen, then one simply moves on. And to the extent that there is that inward compulsion, that divine grip, to that extent one moves a step at a time, not counting the consequences, but doing what one must do. This Jesus was claimed and called and with unswerving faithfulness pursued to the end, to his last breath. Jesus is really somebody. He might have struggled as I suppose any of us would struggle. What if what I see is a challenge to the conventional wisdom of what everybody else thinks? What if what I see runs counter to the whole weight of institutional momentum? What if I dare stand on my truth? Won't my motivation be questioned, if not my sanity? And if I dare act on my truth, what will my parents say? My spouse? Will my children suffer? What will it do to my career advancement, my standing with my peers, if I've seen something? If I dare to live by the truth I've seen, there's a cost involved. But when one has seen something, unless one would deny oneself and lose one's soul, one must be true to what one has seen. One must live into the vision. Luther at one point said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Dietrich Bonhoeffer said in 1939, when he was in this country and could have sat out the Second World War, said to Reinhold Niebuhr, his professor at Union Seminary, "If I am to share in the reconstruction of Germany after the war, I must join my people in their suffering now. For my people are faced with the awful alternative of willing the destruction of their country in order that Christian civilization may be saved, or willing the victory of their country and the destruction of our civilization as we know it. I know which alternative I must choose, but I cannot choose it in safety." And he went back, and he was engaged, and he was killed. But he was also free. Jesus, baptized, claimed, and called. We're going to look to Jesus during these Lenten weeks. Because this is the paradox, this is the mystery. Oh, I hope you see, you hear. This is the mystery. If we could see into the face of Jesus, who lived consciously before the face of God, we would see in the face of Jesus the face of the one before whom he lived. That's the wonder, you see. Not this exalted deity afar off, this one who lived, bone of our bone, flesh of our flesh, if ever we see his face, whose face was face to face with the eternal one. We will see in his face the face of the eternal one. And we'll see the Eternal One in the face of one another as well. That would be a good Lent.